Did you have friends over for dinner last night, Mariama?
I beg your pardon. No, actually, I didn't. And if I did, there wouldn't be any of those sounds. No yucks or spitting of food, thank you very much. I'm a pretty good cook, Sam, I'll have you know.
Interesting. So what's your go-to dish for entertaining friends and guests?
I think I'd probably go for roast vegetables in the oven, some fish as well, some salsa verde, which I would obviously make myself.
Very fancy.
On a bed of couscous.
I like the sound of that.
And what's yours? I mean, given you're a student, I'm guessing something microwaved or involving pot noodles?
I'm a mature student now.
Oh, excuse me.
So those culinary days are behind me. I like to, you know, I think of myself as kind of a cook. So I like to have some, you know, fried chicken, which I make myself. I love a bit of roast veg and, you know, and some rice. And I'm good to go.
I'm starting to get hungry. In case listeners haven't already guessed, today we're going to be discussing a timeless subject. Flavours, aromas, and the chemicals that cause them.
Unless the listener has read the title of this episode, the timeless pun doesn't really work in radio. Mariama meant time, as in the herb, for anyone confused.
Well, I tried. Anyway, welcome listeners. In this episode of Swittering On, we'll be discussing the science behind both flavours and aromas and how they can be recreated in the lab, as well as the chemistry behind them. Hello. I'm Mariama Ifodé-Blease, and I'm the head of education at the Salters Company and Institute in London.
And I'm Sam Yodada, or Sam, and I'm a PhD student at the University of Cambridge in the Department of Chemistry.
We know chemists can do everything. And in this episode, we'll be joined by two guests, a scientist at the top of their game on the subject who knows a lot more about it than us, and a student also on the subject who wants to learn how to address these issues.
In every episode, we will do our best to introduce the main topic under discussion and then pass over to an expert and a student to have a conversation about the past, present, and future of the science at the heart of it.
And as tempting as it might be for the two of us to just sit and nod along, we'll be joining in with the conversation as well.
We are going to be breaking things down for you so you can understand it. So at the risk of embarrassing ourselves, at the end of each episode, we are going to be quizzed by the experts on the key takeaway from the conversations in the expert test.
The expert test. Yes, we will, Sam. And even though I really hated exams at school, we will be keeping score every week and throughout the whole series to see who out of the two of us will be the winner of the expert test. The chemistry of flavours and aromas is an interdisciplinary area, bringing in biology, which covers the receptors within the nose, called the olfactory receptors, and chemistry, which studies the various compounds that make up smell.
Taste are detected by receptors in the taste buds of the tongue, called the gustatory system, which detects sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. The detection of odours, on the other hand, is dependent on the olfactory receptors. The combination of these two systems gives us the perception of taste and smell.
Sweet, sour, salty, bitter. These words could describe people. But alas, we are still talking about tastes. I don't think anyone has ever been described as umami, though.
Umami is always the one that people forget. It was discovered by a Japanese chemist in the early 20th century and translates as savoury. It comes from three compounds that are naturally found in plants and meat, such as glutamate, inosate, and guanylate. The first, glutamate, is an amino acid found in vegetables and meat. When you eat foods with high levels of glutamate, the compound binds to the receptors on your taste buds. This causes the savory taste in your mouth. In response, your body creates more saliva and digestive juices to help break down the proteins that the umami alerts you to.
Our sense of taste isn't just about enjoying that deep-fried Mars bar. It alerts our brain to what we might be eating. For example, when you taste things that are sugary, your brain might be alerting you to carbohydrates, which we know will give you energy. Bitterness warns you that something might be toxic and unsafe to eat. The main function of our sour taste is to prevent ingestion of acids in spoiled foods or unripe fruits, which may cause irritation or illness. Salt, of course, is important too.
Obviously, as an employee of a Salters Institute and Company.
Yes, obviously, I would say that salt was important, Sam. So surely you didn't expect me to miss that opportunity to talk about our funders, the Salters Institute. Thank you very much. Anyway, moving on. The human body requires a small amount of sodium to conduct nerve impulses, contract and relax muscles, and maintain the proper balance of water and minerals. It is estimated that we need about 500 milligrams of sodium daily for these vital functions. And going back to UNAMI, it helps you to recognise amino acids and protein. And since protein is vital to your health, this is also a very important taste.
And to add to that, the Japanese scientist Kikunae Ikeda, who discovered umami, also created monosodium glutamate, or MSG. I'm totally cool with using MSG, but of course, as with all foods, some people can be allergic to it.
Yes, I've been to restaurants that go to great lengths to state that they don't use MSG, and perhaps that's why. Anyhow, what are the questions we're exploring today, Sam?
Well, today, we're going to find out what makes different scents smell different. How does biology link with flavours and aromas? And what are volatile organic compounds? And how are chemicals from foods used or mimic in food science?
Those are really interesting questions, Sam. And I think we've just touched on that last question when we talked a bit about MSG.
I read that some people also like the smell of petrol, which may sound weird.
Yeah, I've heard that too. It's apparently popular with lots of people. Benzene is responsible for the petrol's intoxicating smell. Now, from a mechanical point of view, benzene is added to petrol to improve engine performance and fuel efficiency. On the olfactory side, benzene is both powerful and light, woody and aromatic, dark and green. Thus, most noses are sensitive to it. However, it's really important to remember that it also happens to be extremely carcinogenic.
So I guess we shouldn't go around, you know, sniffing petrol.
No, I wouldn't advise it, Sam.
Are there any particular scents you're into?
Well, I do love honeysuckle, I have to say. It always makes me think of sunny summer days.
Oh, nice.
Shall we start the conversation? It's absolutely fantastic to be joined today by Professor Jane Parker from the University of Reading. Professor Parker is a professor of flavour chemistry, and she also runs the Flavour Centre at the university. Jane, it's wonderful to see you. Thank you for joining us today.
A pleasure to be here.
We're also joined by William Terry-Wright, who is a PhD student at the University of Bristol, kind of focusing on synthetic chemistry.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hi, Will. Good to see you again.
It's a pleasure to be back, as always.
Each episode, we ease our guests into it by asking them the same two questions. So if you were an element, what would it be and why?
I'd have to be sulfur.
Ooh. Tell us more, Jay.
Smelly element. Very Jekyll and Hyde. It can cause some really horrible smells. You know, you think of drains and eggs and things like that. But if you channel it down the right pathways, you get that really nice, meaty aroma. And it's also responsible for a lot of tropical fruit flavours. So mango has, the key components are sulfur compounds, mangoes, tropical fruit, passion fruit, things like that, peaches even, and even in strawberries. So it's a very versatile element in terms of flavour.
Oh, very interesting.
I would never have associated mango with drains, Jay. What a connection.
Will, if you were an element, what would it be and why?
I think I'd probably be silicon, because it's in all of our devices and it's so important for sustainable energy and a sustainable future.
Oh, wonderful. Also, Will, who is your favourite fictional scientist?
I'm going to go for Shuri from the Black Panther, because she uses her knowledge as a scientist to create all these fantastic inventions and make the world a better place.
I love that.
An excellent choice, Will.
And we have a special question for you, Jane. What is your favourite smell or taste?
I think it's got to go back to that sulphur molecule, that those sulphur compounds that are in meat. That smell you get from a bit of roast beef that's been sitting there, you get the scrapings off the bottom of the roasting pan, and that smell is just wonderful.
Oh, wonderful. Love that. What about you, Will?
I have two, really. One of them is coffee, the smell of freshly brewed coffee. And the other one's a little bit weirder. So you mentioned petrol being weird, but I think I can top that. I used to work at a bar, and so every time I walked past a pub or a bar, the smell of slightly aged beer just makes me remember of a time where there was no stress and the worst thing that could happen was someone complaining about the food. So
MBT, 3-methyl-2-butyl-1-thiol.
Well, and now I know.
Smell of skunk and weed. Old beer.
Oh. Yeah, old beer, yeah.
Wow, we've never had beer broken down on this podcast before. You've heard it here first, people. Now that the serious questions are out of the way, let's get into it. Will.
Thank you very much, Mariama. So my first question is, would you be able to tell me a little, or tell us a little bit more about your research and what you do?
Right, I have a diverse research portfolio. I do a lot of different things, and that's why I love it. And part of it, you know, where I started was looking at the Maillard reaction, which is incredibly important in generating all those aromas that are responsible for coffee or chocolate or roast beef or anything like that. It's the Maillard reaction that produces these aromas. And it's a very complex reaction. It starts with amino acids and sugars, and there are multiple pathways in series, in parallel. You've got a whole network of pathways, and what I quite enjoy doing is picking out these pathways, trying to elucidate what exactly is happening to form that smell, and if I tweak that pathway, how does it affect the rest of the Maillard reaction? What might happen somewhere else? So that's the Maillard reaction, and we quite like modelling it and trying to predict what kind of smells you might get. But I'm also interested in trying to work out what gives coffee, for example, its unique smells. Now, there's a lot of work being done on coffee, so we know the answers to that. But, you know, and that's using my nose because, you know, with a lab full of analytical instruments, these instruments can't tell you what smells. So I need to use my nose. And my nose goes on the end of an instrument and I work out what it is that makes coffee smell. But sort of moving northwards up the nose a bit, I'm also interested in olfaction. And that really came to the fore during COVID when people lost their sense of smell. And for some people, it didn't come back for quite a long time. And when it did come back, it came back distorted and really objectionable. And they really had a tough time. And until you lose your sense of smell, you don't realise how important it is. So for me, what I was trying to work out is which molecules are triggering this. And that's fascinating. So I cover quite a long, you know, I cover what's going on in the, what's happening in the field, how things are growing, how flavour's developing in the field, what's going on in the pan, in the casserole dish, how it travels up your nose. And then once it gets to the olfactory bulb, how it sends signals to the the neural processing area. So yeah, quite versatile.
You cover the whole gamut of everything. Perhaps then it'd be good to start off with why are smells different? Why do we smell lemons when we have a fruit bowl or coffee? Why do they exist, all these different smells?
It's a good question. Think first about how we perceive them, which is with our olfactory receptors, which are just at the top of the nose. It's an epithelium that has olfactory receptors on it, and they're neurons that go straight up to the brain, through the skull, up to the olfactory bulb and the olfactory cortex. Now, we've got something like 450 different receptors, and some of them respond. Some of them are very broadly tuned and some of them are very narrowly tuned. So some receptors will only pick up one molecule. Some receptors pick up a wide range of molecules. But what happens, it's a little bit like pattern recognition or like playing a chord on the piano. The smell of lemon will activate a different pattern, a pattern of receptors, and you associate that with lemon. Whereas coffee will activate a different pattern of receptors and give you the coffee aroma. And some of these molecules actually are in both coffee and lemon potentially. But it's amazed how you'd be amazed how many of these aromas pop up in foods that you think are quite different. So it's to do with how we, with the pattern recognition.
And what is it about these the different molecules that activates these receptors in to different extents?
Well, the million-dollar question. We don't actually know.
Oh.
I mean, we know that they bind into the receptors, and one molecule can bind into several receptors, and one receptor can be activated by a number of different molecules. But we really don't fully understand why limonene docking into your receptor number 322 actually gives you a smell of lemon.
Is this the same with, like, you know, taste? So, for example, I know that, is it coriander or parsley, that some people, when they taste it, they have that taste of soapy taste?
Well, yeah, I haven't actually defined what the difference between taste and... You defined it at the beginning, didn't you? So taste is on the tongue. Coriander is, okay, it's the taste of coriander that people find different, but it's actually the aroma. And again, it's not totally understood because there's a genetic basis to it, and we know that. But there are some molecules in coriander that give you that soapy note, and there are some molecules in coriander that give you that nice floral note of coriander. And what we don't really know is whether it's the people that find it soapy, if they've got more receptors for the soapy bit, so the soapiness is enhanced, or fewer receptors for the other bit, the floral bit, so that, you know, they don't get the floral bit, they only get the soapy bit. The soapy bit masks the floral bit.
So Mariama and Sam briefly mentioned MSG. Would you be able to explain what MSG is and why some people rave about it and other people hate it?
Okay, so MSG is a naturally occurring amino acid. The amino acid is glutamate. MSG is the monosodium salt of glutamate. And it's essential. It's in the body. It's essential for neurotransmission. So you need it. And it's one of the things in breast milk that babies latch onto. It's one of the first things that they can perceive is the high concentration of MSG. So it's perfectly safe. Contrary to what a lot of people believe, MSG is perfectly safe. It's used in Asia along with salt and pepper, and there's a jar of MSG to sprinkle on your food. So there's, yeah.
I didn't know that it was one of the first things that babies can detect. We briefly touched on it in the intro and just now. How is our perception of taste and smell, how is that different?
Yeah, I mean, Sam did touch on that. And it's, as a scientist, we define our words carefully, whereas, you know, the general public, you use taste and flavour to mean anything. You finish a meal and you said it tasted great, when actually it probably had a good flavour. So all these words get very muddled up. But as scientists, we define taste as what's in the tongue. So that's salty, sweet, sour, bitter, umami, as you've already said. And aroma is what you perceive with the nose. And that's all these other volatile organic compounds that we started to talk about. And for me, flavour is the sum of those two. So the flavour's not in the cup. The aroma molecules are in the coffee cup. The bitter taste components are in the coffee cup. Flavour is a very individual thing. So how you perceive coffee might be different. How you, Sam, perceive coffee might be different to how you will perceive it, because you've got different receptors, different genes. So flavour is that overall integration of taste and aroma. And sometimes people include other things in that, you know, as well. It depends. Some people say the colour also influences how you taste things. The sound can. And the chemisthesis. Now, chemisthesis is a chemical interaction that it's generated by irritants in your food, like chili, like capsaicin. Mm-hmm. Capsaicin in chilies is an irritant, and that contributes to taste as well.
You mentioned briefly there volatile organic compounds. Could you explain just a little bit about what that is?
It's a term that many people use. We don't tend to use it as aromachemists, but it's a kind of term that most people understand, in that it's the molecules that are volatile, so they're easily transferred from the coffee into the air, so that they can go up through your nose and hit that epithelium. So they're volatile, they partition into the air, and you can smell them.
And is that what causes all aromas, or are some slightly different?
Some are a little bit more polar and a little bit less volatile, but in general, yes, because they've got to, for aromas, it's got to get up your nose.
Mm. So it's got to be able to get into the air. And why do dogs have such a better sense of smell? Because we've all heard of sniffer dogs that go searching for truffles, or in airports searching for drugs. Why are they so much better at detecting smells or aromas than we are?
There's a few reasons. I mean, we as humans have about 5 million olfactory receptors. Dogs have something like 100 million at least, or more. So they've got more receptors to start off with over a larger surface area. The architecture in their nose is slightly different as well. So they can, whereas we have to, when we're sniffing, we have to stop and breathe. Dogs can actually continue sniffing and breathing at the same time, so because they've got two channels, so they can continue sniffing. And they've got a larger proportion of their brain is dedicated to olfaction as well. So a number of reasons there.
Wow. You mentioned it earlier, but what is the Maillard reaction, and why is it so important in how we enjoy our food, especially when we're kind of cooking?
Where am I going to start? I was going to start with, you know, thinking about the role of molecules, or the role of chemistry in food, because very few people think about food as a mixture of chemicals, but in fact it's a big mix of molecules, and those are carbohydrates, fats, lipids, proteins, water, minerals. And these are all in a complex matrix, a complex structure, but they can all come into contact with each other and interact with each other. And this is where the Maillard reaction comes in, because during heating, all these molecules that are in your raw coffee beans, for example, since we're focusing on coffee, when you heat them up, you've got all these reactive compounds in your coffee bean. They react, and that's when it's a reaction between proteins, so amino acids, and reducing sugars, that's the Maillard reaction, and that creates a huge number of volatile aroma compounds, which give you that sense of roast coffee. Chocolate's the same. You get the Maillard reaction in chocolate. Meat, you get the Maillard reaction happening in meat. Anything you cook, you get the Maillard reaction happening. But there's also lipids in there, and they can degrade and give you lipidy smells, and then the compounds that are formed from the lipids can interact with the compounds that are formed from the Maillard reaction, and you can just keep on, I think there's something like 4,000 volatile compounds in roast meat that you can't smell them all. You smell a subset, but, you know, the number of volatile organic compounds that are formed from the Maillard reaction is huge. It was discovered by Louis-Camille Maillard in 1912, but a lot of the elucidation of the chemical pathways was carried out 50 years later by an African-American chemist working in the US called John Hodge. So he is really the chemist who's elucidated all the reaction pathways, and should get more credit than he actually does.
So it's more of a series of reactions rather than just one singular reaction.
Oh, it's a huge pot, a mixing pot of reactions, yeah.
Is it possible to bottle these smells? Like, could you buy a perfume that's just coffee, or, I don't know, toast?
You can tell who on this podcast loves coffee. Just makes you go up the wall. Give me a cup of tea any day.
And yeah, the flavour houses do it every day. Mm. The flavour houses are working out what the key aroma compounds are in coffee and blending them together to make a coffee aroma. So yes, but I guess what's more interesting is meat, because that's far more complex. Can you bottle meat? And there's something called a process reaction in the food industry, flavour industry, where you actually take the precursors that would be present in meat. So you take the ribose and the amino acids, and you mix them together outside of the meat, if you like, in a jar. You heat them up under conditions that are similar to cooking, and you can create meat flavours in a jar.
Is that what they're using for, like, vegan meat? Do they add these aromas and flavours in by doing that?
I believe they do, mm-hmm. yes. But it gets even more complicated than that, because trying to add a meat flavour into something that's not meat, you get interactions between the matrix and the meat flavour. So generating meat flavour in meat, you get what we know as meat. But trying to add a meaty flavour to something that isn't meat is not easy. It's a huge challenge.
And do we have similarly complex flavour, is that the right word, am I using, in the vegetable kingdom for those who don't eat meat? When you're talking about the complexity of meat, is that replicated when it's not meat?
Meat, coffee and cocoa are the three most complex things that I've ever analysed. When we get onto vegetables, you get less. They're not as complex.
Okay.
They're not as complex.
Fascinating.
And can I ask what your research focuses on? Does it focus on developing new flavours, or analysing existing flavours, or a mixture of both, or neither of them?
Well, my research is really about understanding how flavour, and I say flavour in the wrong sense, how aroma is formed in meat. I have a lot of expertise in meat aroma. So, and that's all about trying to understand how meat aroma is formed. And then, can we apply that in a vegan situation? Because it's not quite as simple as just adding a meat flavouring from a flavour house. So trying to understand the intricacies of the Maillard reaction. More of what I do is understanding, influencing, seeing the impact of raw materials. So if you've got coffee beans from a different country, a different mountain, a different climate, a different variety, how does that have an impact on the aroma of the coffee, for example? So it's more about understanding that. We don't create flavours. We don't generate flavourings. That's not what I do as a flavour chemist. That's what the flavourists do. They create flavourings from what we tell them. So we can analyse. We analyse whatever they want. That gives them a little bit of a start as to what the chemicals might be that they need to mix to get a nice flavouring. But a lot of what happens after that is just the flavourist's expertise. It's an art, it's knowing what to add. The chemistry is the start, and then from then on, a flavourist will take a flavouring and develop it and for a specific application. Because, of course, flavourings, you know, you can create a strawberry flavouring, but it'll behave differently in a yoghurt, it'll behave differently in strawberry laces, it'll behave differently in strawberry daiquiri. The other components of the food have an impact.
And does that mean we can make our cooking better, or taste better, or smell better by using this knowledge? Or is that beyond?
Well, I guess there's two levels to that question. There's the very basic level, thinking about how do I use this in my everyday cooking? And if I end up with a casserole or a soup that's a bit tasteless, I go back to taste and umami and what's missing. And quite often in soup, you've got, well, umami taste, you've got the glutamate and you've got the nucleotides, which are the inosine and the guanylate, the inosine monophosphate and the guanosine monophosphate, and they behave synergistically. So when you put them together, you get this explosion of umami. So if you haven't cooked your stock for long enough and generated enough of the nucleotides, can you get them from somewhere else? So add a bit of mushroom ketchup or Worcester sauce or something to boost the nucleotide part of the synergy, because you've probably already got the other part. So, you know, I quite often dash of Worcester sauce, dash of mushroom sauce. Thinking about cooking, you know, how do you get things to go brown? Obviously, every cook knows that the longer you cook, higher temperature, you get brown, you get more browning. But what else? If you dry the surface, that encourages the Maillard reaction. So drying the surface will help. Roast potatoes. My mother used to peel them on Christmas Eve and put them in a bowl so that they were ready for Christmas Day. And then she complained that the roast potatoes didn't turn brown and blamed the oven or the fact that everybody else was cooking at the same time. But actually what happens when they're steeping in that bowl of water is that all the precursors to the Maillard reaction leach out.
Into the water.
So there's nothing else, nothing left. They don't go brown. So on that level, you know, just thinking a little bit about what you, how you cook every day is fine. I suppose at the other level, it's always about ensuring you've got the best raw materials, the best raw ingredients, maximum precursors, freshness, things like that. Because, you know, we do look at freshness and rancidity. I've got a project looking at rancidity of millet, which is quite an exciting project because, you know, we're trying to encourage more consumption of millet, both in the UK and in Sub-Saharan Africa, India, because it's healthy, it's high fibre, it's nutritious, high protein, higher in minerals, but it goes off. So people are switching to rice, wheat and maize. This is a nice project because I'm making a difference to people. If we can ensure that that shelf life is longer, we can prevent the millet from going rancid, then there's more chance that people will take it up and start eating it. Can we make it taste better?
It's like the three sisters, you know, the corn, squash and beans, yes. So there is a lot of talk in certainly in the environmental space about could we go back to the three sisters because they may be able to withstand more of some of the extreme weather we're seeing with the climate emergency. I don't know whether you have any thoughts on that, Jane, and whether you're, because you've talked about feeding populations, whether you think that actually your work directly or indirectly, you know, contributes to some of these discussions about the crops that will be able to withstand more extreme weather.
It does indeed. I don't know much about corn, squash and beans, but I do know millet and sorghum and things like that were traditionally used, are traditional foods, but people have started swapping them for rice, wheat and maize as they've become more available and they've got better shelf life. They don't go off so much. But what we're trying to do is encourage people to go back to the traditional because sorghum and millet, they are drought resistant. They can be grown as the climate changes. They are far more suitable to growing in that area compared to wheat and maize. So that's exactly what we're trying to do is encourage people to go back to their traditional crops, which are healthier and healthy for people and healthy for planet is the tagline. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I think we're very fast becoming a cooking podcast.
I'm getting hungry. Yeah. Getting hungry. Well,
I can't complain. So hopefully we've all learned a little bit. So my final question will be, what excites you about your research? What do you find most fascinating?
What I enjoy most about my research is the breadth of it, the interdisciplinary nature. You know, I'm a chemist by training, so one day I'll be working with round bottom flasks and test tubes, and another day I'll be working with high-powered analytical instruments, and then maybe I'm working with a sensory panel trying to get people to describe how they perceive things, or maybe I'm using my own nose, or maybe I'm helping people with parosmia, measuring their olfaction. And then I think the last and the most, the one that's probably the most exciting is and can make a difference is what I was talking about just a minute ago on the millet and the sorghum and the traditional crops. Because, you know, by getting those to taste right, we can have an impact on health in the UK and health in the in Asia.
Yeah. Wow. Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Jane, thank you so much. I think that you are inspiring us with the way that your research leads and impacts real life and the applications of how food is distributed and grown. And what's the future of this field? Do you have enough chemists?
We don't. There are many openings in industry for food chemists. We need food chemists. We need all sorts of food chemists. We need analytical chemists. We need organic chemists. We need biochemists. You know, the chemists of all sorts are employed in the food industry. And the food, you know, we certainly, as we're looking at developing food for the future, we absolutely need chemists to come in and design proteins and There is a serious shortage of food chemists in the UK, and I think we need to be able to attract youngsters into food science, into food chemistry, and even convert people with chemistry degrees into food chemists and flavour chemists, because there is so much chemistry involved in food, and I hope I've demonstrated that by talking to you earlier. But, you know, there is a lot of detailed chemistry. People underestimate the chemistry that's involved. I mean, I'm looking at addition reactions and aldol condensations and things that I learned back, you know, real organic chemistry, real analytical chemistry, real physical chemistry, all about the partitioning of aromas into headspace, partitioning of aromas in gels and emulsions and stability. It's broad, and I think people don't realise the potential for chemists in the food industry. We really want to encourage people to consider careers in food chemistry and food science.
Jane, that was an inspiring and passionate call, and I hope that all our young listeners and listeners who are maybe a bit older but feel quite young will consider chemistry and all the breadth and options that it offers. Thank you, Jane.
It's now time for you to do the incredibly hard task of breaking this all down for our listeners to a 1 minute summary, so we can have, you know, a take home message from everything that you've been able to give to us.
Okay, so I think the take home message starts with food is made up of chemicals, it's made up of molecules, and those are the precursors. That's what is responsible for forming flavour once you start cooking. Or in the case of fresh vegetables, it can be when you start chopping them up. That's when flavour is generated. So the quality of your raw materials is key to generating really good flavour. Flavour, I'll just reiterate, is composed of taste, which is perceived by the tongue, and aroma, which is perceived by the nose, and flavour is those two combined. So that's the overall flavour of a dish. We tend to call it the taste of a dish. There's a difficult distinction. The Maillard reaction is key to forming roasty, toasty aromas. And then you've got the lipids, which also add to that by generating fried notes. Working my way up from the casserole, up my nose a little bit, that's where we actually perceive aroma. There are something like 450 different olfactory receptors, and it's pattern recognition that we use to identify whether we're drinking coffee or lemon juice. And from there, the signals go to the brain, where we interpret all the signals and come out with the final perception of flavour.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for that brilliant breakdown, Jane. I think we've learned even more just through the summary. So now it is the time that we have all been waiting for. Well, maybe not you, Sam. for our guest expert, Jane, to ask some questions just to check that we've been listening. Will, are you happy to keep score?
Absolutely, as always.
I think I may have a lead here, but I'm not going to get too confident because, you know, Sam can come through and still impress. Sam, I hope you're ready. I hope you've been flexing your muscles.
I was born ready.
And listening. Right, Jane, over to you.
So, have you been listening? So, I would like to know who the chemist is that was responsible for elucidating all the chemical pathways in the Maillard reaction.
It was the African American guy. I've forgotten his name. It's something. Is it Jake?
John. Yes.
John.
We'll just call him John.
Hodges.
Nearly.
Just.
Hodge.
Oh. I practically gave that to you on a plate.
No, but
Sam.
I also described who it was.
Oh, well.
Yeah, I'm going to have to give that one very narrowly to Sam. It's a very close one, though.
Will, I'll remember this.
I'll give you the next one.
So my next one is, what kind of aroma compounds are responsible for the smell of passion fruit?
Sulfur.
Salt.
Yes.
That's a Mariama's point.
Oh my gosh, it's neck and neck. I think we need a tiebreaker question, Jane.
I could ask you to name the compounds that are responsible for umami taste. There's two different kinds, so I want one of each.
Oh my goodness.
Well, glutamate, no?
That's one.
Yeah.
And
inosate?
Yes, almost. It's got lots of different names, but I'll give you, well, if I'm allowed to, I'll give you that one.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Oh my goodness, Jane.
There we go. How does
that
feel?
That was very tense.
That was very close.
Will, can you confirm the score, even though I know deep
unfortunately
down?
For you, Mariama, it's 2-1 to Sam today.
Very I just low. Have to let him win once in a while.
What? I'm sure you'll come back stronger next time.
I will come back stronger next time. I absolutely will. Jane, it's been absolutely fantastic to have you here. Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing your wonderful expertise with us and your knowledge as well. Thank you to Will for being such an objective umpire and for facilitating a really inspiring conversation with Professor Jane Parker. And I couldn't leave the podcast without thanking Sam. Sam, thank you. It's fabulous to have you again in the studio and to be co-presenting with you.
Thank you.
And last but not least, thank you to you, our listeners, for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did. Make sure to tune in for the next episode of Zwittering On. And if you'd like to find out more about our work, you can follow us on our socials or go to our website, saltersinstitute.org.